1 Corinthians 7:10 through 7:24, the 20th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 28, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good morning. We're going to continue in 1 Corinthians this morning. We're in chapter 7. Let me just remind you that whereas this is a chapter that we often go to thinking, oh, this is the chapter where Paul talks about how marriage isn't very good, or this is the chapter where we go to find out some more rules about divorce or something like that, that the way to understand what's happening in this chapter is to see it all arising from a question that we're having to somewhat deduce from what Paul has said in the chapter, but it's a question that has been raised by the Corinthians that has something to do with his opening statement that he makes, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And I've been arguing that the issue is that there are those in Corinth who have developed this sort of hyper-spiritual view of sexuality where they think that the best thing, the most spiritual thing, would be to just stay away from it altogether. And Paul has been speaking to that issue. They seem to have raised, in their circumstances, they have various people trying to sort it out in various ways, and Paul is sort of going step by step and dealing with various possibilities. He started out talking about the situation where a couple is married, but one of them has decided that abstinence is more holy somehow. Then he moves on, I think, to those who used to be married, widowers and widows. And then he next speaks to those who are married but are considering divorce. And in the context, I think, the issue is not just divorce in general, but the idea that somehow it would be better to be unmarried. That in the light of this, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, that they've decided, okay, sure, you're right, we shouldn't live together and abstain. What we ought to do is just split up and go our separate ways. And to each of these situations, Paul has been speaking. So we come then to verse 12 of chapter 7, where he comes to another situation. And let me read that to you. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, let him not send her away. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, let her not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Okay. He starts out here by saying, to the rest. He's been saying, okay, to this group and to this group, and now he says to the rest. He doesn't mean to the rest of everyone, married, unmarried, whatever might be. Obviously, he has a particular group in mind. And I think what's happened here is they have asked him about the basic situation of the married and the used to be married and what ought they to do. And he's saying, okay, and I've got one case left to deal with here. To the rest, as far as the remaining group is concerned, here's what I have to say. So I've covered the various sorts of married people, and regarding this issue that you asked me about, the married and abstinent, the formerly married, the married but considering divorce, I've got this one issue left to deal with concerning married people as far as you've raised it, And that is those who are believers married to unbelievers. What ought to happen in that case? Now, again, I think you have to keep in mind, we come to this thinking, here's Paul, he wants to set out, let me tell you what the rule is regarding believers and unbelievers in and their being married. He's coming at this from the angle of the question that they're asking. So I think the question has to be understood in the light of the issue that has been raised. There is a group in Corinth who think that it is superior to abstain from sexual relations, that that's a more holy way of life, and that now that they have become believers in Christ, God has called them to a holier way of life, and so that's what they ought to do. In this context, then, if you think about the issue of a believer being married to an unbeliever, that just adds fuel to the fire. What they're going to be thinking is, okay, now surely, if the holiest calling is to abstain altogether, then surely if a believer is married to an unbeliever, then you've got to have abstinence there. I mean, you basically got to split that up, right? Because that's a holy person having physical relations with an unholy person. You can't have that. Surely God can't intend that to happen. I mean, obviously, lack of sexuality is the highest calling, and certainly it would have to be the highest calling if you're talking about a believer and an unbeliever, right? That's the perspective I think that the people that Paul is writing to are coming from. Now, he says this interesting phrase. He says to this group, I say, not the Lord. And people have gotten kind of tripped up by this. This is a very interesting chapter, a unique chapter in Paul's letters, really. It's hard to find any other section quite like it, where you have this language that seems to distinguish as if he's saying, I'm saying this. God isn't saying this, I'm saying this. And this language where in several places he expresses his opinion about things. He usually doesn't use this kind of language. It's pretty much, you've got this problem, well, here's the deal. Here's what you need to do about it. I think we need to see it in this way. There's kind of these layers to his presentation here. At the top, the most important would be when he says in the last one, he says, the Lord says, not I. And what he means there is, this issue, the general issue of divorce, we have Jesus himself, the Lord himself, telling us how we ought to think about this. We have the principles that he laid down, that what God has joined together, let no one separate. And the idea that moving on, abandoning this person so I can marry this person would be adultery and that sort of thing. We've got Jesus talking about that already. Then we come to this statement where he says, I say, not the Lord. I think all he means by this is, whereas we have a specific teaching from Jesus about the general issue of divorce, we have no specific teaching from Jesus about the issue of a believer married to an unbeliever. I can't point you to a saying of Jesus, he's saying, that would tell us what you ought to do in this situation. So I'm saying this. But this doesn't imply that he thinks that this is just his opinion or there isn't a moral issue involved with it. He is just making clear to them that the pronouncement that he's making here is his pronouncement, not Jesus. But he is, in fact, an apostle of Christ. And then, even farther down on the ladder of how much importance we're giving to the statement, there are these statements that he makes clear are his opinion. He has the perspective that there is an advantage to being unmarried, and he talks about this in various places and gives it as his opinion, even while he is also saying, but you're free to do otherwise. You're quite free to marry, even though I'm saying to, say, the widow, that you would do well to remain unmarried. You have the freedom to marry. I'm not giving you a command. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm giving you my opinion that this would be a good thing to do. That's not what's happening in this statement when he says, not the Lord, but I say. He's not indicating that this is just his opinion, so you're free to do otherwise. Here he's saying, I don't have a commandment of the Lord, but this is what you ought to do. So I hope that distinction is clear. We actually, as we go through this section, we have to kind of rank what he's saying in terms of, is he saying there is a moral requirement that tells me I ought to behave in this way? Or is he just saying, I think that the advantage lies in going this way, but you're free to do what you want? Sometimes he's doing one and sometimes he's doing the other. Here, I think he is saying, no, there is a moral issue involved. When he addresses the issue of the believer married to the unbeliever, he's not saying, oh, do what you want. My opinion is you ought to stay married, but go ahead and do whatever you want. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, I don't have a specific commandment of Jesus, but I'll tell you what you need to do. You're married to that person, and you need to stay married to them. Okay. What does he say? Here's the situation, and here's what he says to do. If any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, let him not send her away. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, let her not send her husband away. Like I said, the issue is this question. Is it the case that it is good for a man not to touch a woman? And doesn't that lead us in this case to say, wouldn't it be better to definitely stay away from? You don't want to be married to an unbeliever. You're having this polluting contact. You're having this physical relationship with someone that doesn't even belong to God. If sexuality is something that makes you less holy, certainly sexual relations with someone that is an unbeliever is really going to make you less holy. Well, what Paul answers them, as I understand it basically, is once again, they're thinking about this issue wrong. That's not the way to think about it. It's not an issue of somehow being ritually polluted or experiencing some sort of spiritual pollution by being in contact with an unbeliever. The issue is a moral one. This is the person to whom I am married. This is the person that I made my marriage vows to. So therefore, I ought to stay married to them. I'm not experiencing some sort of pollution in this context. The fact is, I made a promise to them to be married, and I should keep that promise. The question that's on the table is, what does God want? And some of the Corinthians are thinking, what God wants is this kind of hyper-spiritual purity, where I stay away from any contaminating influences like sex, and certainly having a sexual relationship with an unbeliever. But what Paul's saying, no, it's not ritual purity that is the issue, it is morality. The fact is that you are married to this person. That's where the right of the thing is. If you want to know what God wants, he wants you to keep your marriage vows. That's what he wants. Now, he then goes on to give a reason, I think, why he would see it in this way and why their thinking about this issue is wrong. In what I have always thought of as being one of the weirder verses in the Bible. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Okay. Well, the reason I always thought that this was a weird verse is because I always read it without really thinking about what the issue is in the chapter and what the specific thing he's addressing is. Remember, he's saying this as an argument to the Corinthians who have a certain perspective that he's fighting. So, to me, this is kind of a classic example of how much difference it makes whether you look at verses like this in the context of the whole issue or whether you just pull them out and treat them on their own. Because if you just pull this out by itself, it sounds kind of weird. The believer sanctifies the unbeliever through marriage. What is that? I mean, we have this unholy person walking through the world, but they're fortunate enough to have physical contact with me, the believer, and I have sanctified them. You know, now there's this holiness that has come upon them because they're married to me. And otherwise, presumably, there are these children walking through the world, the product of this unholy union of unholy people. But fortunately, my children have the blessing of being sanctified because I was their parent. What does that mean? And people run in all kinds of directions with this. Oh, my children are holy. So normal children aren't holy, but my children are holy. And that must mean that there's some special blessing that God has for them. And we can wrap this up with people thinking about infant baptism and all kinds of things to get this idea that somehow there's this unique, special relationship that my children have to God. It's almost like by being physically descended from me, they have entered into a kind of salvation or something like that. And we can go in very, very strange directions with this. But I think if we remember the issue that's running through this whole chapter, it's not hard to see what he's saying, and it's not that weird at all. And it's not weird. Remember where the Corinthians are coming from, some of them. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. And in particular, if the holiest thing is to abstain, certainly I need to get out of this relationship with an unbeliever. That would be really staining and unpurifying. Well, what Paul is arguing is no, it goes the other direction. It's not that you are polluted by the relationship with the unbeliever. It is that the unbeliever is sanctified by the relationship with you. Now, sanctified in what sense? Are we talking about sanctification in the sense of salvation, that they have moved from death into life? No. In fact, in a few verses, Paul's going to make that statement. How do you know whether you're going to save your spouse or not? It's not by being married to me that an unbelieving spouse would get saved. That's not what he means. Sanctified in what sense? Well, the issue in this whole thing has been whether, from God's perspective, the holiest existence is to abstain from sexuality, and in this case, especially to abstain, to move apart from the unbelieving spouse. Saying, would I be most holy if I were to separate from them? No, because by the virtue of the fact that they are married to me, that relationship has been sanctified. It's not that that unbeliever is polluting me. It's that I am married to them. Therefore, in God's eyes, they are my husband or wife. They are sanctified. They are appropriate. This is an appropriate person for me to be having a physical relationship because they're my spouse. It's not that in this relationship they're polluting me, so I need to get out of it. It's rather that in this relationship we are married people, therefore that person has been sanctified, not sanctified as in their relationship with God so that they're going to be saved, but sanctified as my spouse. In God's eyes, this is a good thing because we're married. The fact that I'm a believer and they're not doesn't change the fact that we're married. And so in God's eyes, this is a good thing. They're not making me bad. The fact that I'm married to them makes them an acceptable thing to God. And then I think what Paul goes on to say shows that it makes it even clearer. When he says, for otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. This is not Paul going out into the Twilight Zone or something. He's turning their argument back on them, I think. Saying, look, if what you're saying is that the physical relationship between a believer and an unbeliever somehow pollutes the unbeliever so that we have this unholy relationship happening here, the fact that they're married, then what are we going to say about your children? Because your children are, in fact, the product of this relationship that you're involved in here. Are you going to tell me that your children are somehow a product of this unholy union and therefore an unclean phenomenon. God doesn't accept them. They're somehow illegitimate because you're married to an unbeliever. That would kind of be the implication of your view, Corinthians. No, that's not right. I mean, obviously, you're married, you have these children. From God's perspective, your children are sanctified. That is, they are a perfectly legitimate product of your marriage. So, again, the issue for Paul is, you guys are concerned about some sort of hyper-spiritual ritual purity before God, where you're not polluted by the physical or the unbeliever, whereas God is looking at it from an entirely different perspective. It is a natural and moral part of the creation that He has made. You're married to this person and you have children. That's the way it works. There's nothing unholy or second best about it. From God's perspective, this is a sanctified relationship. Your husband is appropriately your husband, even if he is an unbeliever, because you're married to him. And your children are appropriately and legitimately your children, because you are married and you had these children. So it's all been sanctified. From God's perspective, the whole relationship, you, your spouse, and your children, are an acceptable, holy thing. You don't have to change it, in other words. You don't have to somehow pull apart from this in order to make it holy. It's already holy from God's perspective. The fact that you're an obedient believer who is keeping your marriage vows and taking care of the children that result from that, that's a holy thing. Don't mess with it. Don't pull apart from it. Don't change it. It's the way it ought to be. I think that's what Paul is saying to them. So in that case, then, this idea of being sanctified is not some mystical thing. It's just saying this is a good and acceptable thing to God. Don't think that you have to change it to make Him pleased with you. It's fine the way it is. That's the way He made things. Now you recognize, I just make a side comment, that you recognize that this is not Paul's advice to someone who is considering marrying an unbeliever. That would be a different issue. I think if I have the choice in front of me, now we start to get into that language of being unequally yoked and all of that kind of stuff. The lack of wisdom that it would be on my part to choose to enter into a marriage with someone who is not a believer because of what marriage is, I am making it very much more difficult to become one with that person when we are at odds over something so fundamental in life. He's not speaking to that issue. He's speaking to people who are already married. Maybe they were married and one of them became a believer, or however it happened. I mean, however it came about, the fact is that they're married now, and now one of them is thinking, the believer is thinking, oh, God can't like this. I need to get out of this. And he's saying, no, that's not the way it is. The fact is now that you are married, and marriage is an appropriate thing. But he does recognize that there is a challenge here, because he does now turn it around on the other side. If the person is not willing to stay, if you're being married to the unbeliever, the fact that you're a believer and they're not has become a problem, and they don't want to be there. I'm not interested in being married to a weirdo who thinks that Jesus rose from the dead or something like that. I'm out of here. In that situation, then, he's saying basically that the believer, the brother or the sister, is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. He says, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. I think now he's turning it around on the other side. It is not that somehow I need to turn it around and think, therefore, that it is my responsibility. I am going to save this person. I'm the believer who is married to this unbeliever, and it's my responsibility to make sure that I keep this relationship together so that they somehow can be influenced by me and come to salvation or something like that. I think that's what he has in mind, because look what he says to follow it up. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Don't think that somehow it has fallen on your shoulders to be the salvation of that other person. What Paul's advice is, just common sense here. Don't split this relationship up because you think somehow it's unholy and you're being tainted by it. On the other hand, don't think that you have this obligation to somehow keep it intact because it's on your shoulders to save the other person in this relationship. The fact is, you do what you need to do. You made a marriage commitment, keep it. If the other person won't keep it, then that's not your, it's not your job to make sure that they do that. That's ultimately going to be their decision. And recognize that in the end, it is only God who is going to be able to save the other person and not you. Okay, so in this situation, I think Paul, basically his advice, although it sounds strange at first, he's basically just saying something commonsensical, saying something that ought to make sense to us, that it is not the fact that this relationship is somehow some kind of an unholy impurity that you need to get out of. The fact is, it's just a marriage. And a marriage is a good thing. A marriage is something that you as a believer need to be committed to and keep your vows. But at the same time, it is not life itself. And in the end, it's your decision to be faithful to God that is significant, not whether the other person maintains the relationship or not. That's how Paul wants them to think about it. Now, he follows this up with a section that seems to be at first kind of coming out of left field, because he's going to start talking about circumcision and being a slave. And what does that have to do with what he's just been talking about? Well, I think it has a lot to do with it, but we have to kind of unpack it here a little bit and see where what he's getting at. This actually, I think, follows right upon what he just said and fits with it, because he wants to talk about a principle that is a part of, that is informing what he just said about how they ought to look at their marriage. And actually, it informs everything that he said up to this point. He says in verse 17, "Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. And thus I direct in all the churches. Was any man called already circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Let each man remain in that condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called." Okay. So, he says, "Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk, and thus I direct in all the churches." Again, we have to come at this seeing the kind of issue that we're talking about. There's something specific he has in mind. One of the mistakes that we make is jumping off of statements like this and running in all directions without thinking about what kind of thing does he have in mind. Obviously, he doesn't mean if when you became a believer you were a drug dealer, you should keep being a drug dealer. And I think also the evidence suggests that he does not mean that if you were working at the grocery store when you became a believer, by no means try to get a better job. Don't ever leave that job. Stay right where you are. He's not trying to dictate the circumstances of my life. He's saying, when you were saved, there was this freeze frame that was taken and nothing should change from that moment on. No, that's not what he's got in mind. The issue is, how does the change from being an unbeliever to a believer, how does that call on me to change my life? That's what we have been exploring in this chapter in a very specific sense. the Corinthians have gotten this idea that their believing in Jesus and following God has called them to make a certain sacrifice. They're supposed to get out of the relationships that they're in and keep themselves solely for God. If I'm married, I should stop having sexual relations with my spouse, or I should get divorced and get out of it altogether. Or if I'm married to an unbeliever, I should certainly get out of there. The idea being that my call to holiness requires me to make this move of dedication, to purify my life and conduct it in a certain way. Well, my understanding of what Paul is about to do here is what he wants to say is, there is a moral call on my life. When I come to follow God, yes, I have to change the way I have been living and thinking about things, in the sense that I now need to believe that God is there and believe His promises and follow Him and obey His moral call. But that's very far from saying that I need to make some sort of dramatic, religious, ritualized shift in my life in order to show my dedication to God. The issue in this section, as I said, has been, am I called upon to abstain from physical relationships out of a higher calling to holiness? Paul's general principle is, it doesn't matter. That's not what holiness is about. That's just one of those issues you face in life. Some people are married and some people are not. And you're not more or less holy by virtue of which you choose to do. What Paul wants to do is now to bring up a couple of other issues that are like that, where in becoming a believer, people are tempted to think, I need to make this big shift in the circumstances of my life in order to follow God. And what he wants to say is basically, no, just stay the way you are. Following God does not require you to make this shift. It requires you to make a moral shift, but it doesn't require you to make this shift of circumstances that you think it does. Okay, so the first issue he talks about, was any man called already circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? Let him not be circumcised. Now, I think the way we should understand this language is circumcised, uncircumcised is meant to represent being Jewish or not. I mean, it is very, very common for the people at that time to use the language to say of someone that they're uncircumcised means they're a Gentile. To say they belong to the circumcision means they're Jews. So I think the issue that he's confronting here is, am I called upon to change the circumstances of my life? The Jew-Gentile distinction used to be a very important one. If you were a Jew or not a Jew, it made a great difference. Now I'm a follower of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah. Am I called upon, therefore, to make some dramatic shift? If I'm not a Jew, should I become one? If I am a Jew, should I stop being a Jew and live as a Gentile? And Paul's basic answer to them is, don't worry about it. Just stay the way you are. If you're Jewish, you can continue to be Jewish. If you're a Gentile, you can continue to be Gentile. Because that's not the point. What following God looks like does not require that you be one or the other of those things. What it requires is that you are obedient to God in the context of whichever life you are living. He says, circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Now, I know we're kind of used to this sort of idea 2,000 years down the line, but I think we should stop for a second and realize what a bombshell of a statement this would be in the mouth of a dedicated Pharisee like Paul. I mean, he was raised as a Pharisee, trained as a Pharisee, thought of himself as like the Jew of all Jews. I mean, this is the man. He took the law very seriously and the requirements for Jews under the law. This was a huge deal to him in his life. And yet here he is saying, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. It doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. And what's very striking about what he says is what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Because his Jewish opponents would have said, right, what matters is keeping the commandments of God. And what we have in the law is a commandment to be circumcised, so we'd better do that. Here's Paul saying, circumcision is nothing. What matters is keeping the commandments of God. There's a profound truth there. There's a profound shift in Paul's thinking that comes through there, that in his mind, the keeping of the commandments of God is talking about the more basic, fundamental moral requirements of God. That he in his mind would make a distinction between something like circumcision, which was a commandment that God gave the Jews as a specific requirement under the covenant that he made with them, that they were going to live a certain religious kind of life and he would bless them in the land. Okay, that's one kind of commandment, but it was a provisional commandment. It was given to Jews and it was for a certain time and a certain purpose. But the fact is, what God really cares about is that we keep his commandments with a capital C. I mean, that we love God with all our heart, that we love our neighbor as ourselves, that we trust God and follow him, that we not love the things of this world, and so on. I mean, in Paul's mind, making the big show of, well, to show my devotion to God, I'm going to become a Jew, or vice versa, you think, that's not what God's looking for. I mean, it's fine. You want to do that, it's fine. But it is nothing. It doesn't amount to anything because it's not the issue. Let each man remain in that condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Now we come to the second issue. Do not worry about it. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. Now, we can understand that slavery would have been a big issue back here. Certainly a big issue for the person who was a slave. But also, I think, it represented something of a religious problem. I am bound to a master, but now I have aligned myself with Jesus, who is my true master. Does it require me then somehow to get out from all human relationships? Do I have to stop being a slave so that I am not serving this person over here, but I'm only serving Jesus? Does it require me, in other words, to make this dramatic break in my life? And what Paul says is basically no. Stay in the condition in which you were called. God is not requiring you to change. He's not requiring you to get out of your service to your human master in order to follow Jesus. Now, he adds this part, if you are able to become free, do that. Because he's not denying that there are personal reasons why a person might want to stop being a slave and be free. And he's not, and I think he's making it clear here, my commandment to stay as you are does not mean that there's something wrong with trying to change your circumstances if, for your own sake, you think it would be better to be over here than over here. There's nothing wrong with being a slave who wants to be free. And if the opportunity comes up, taking the opportunity to get free. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, go for it, he's saying. If that can happen, great. But what you don't want to do is get the idea that somehow God requires you to do this so that you can demonstrate your devotion to him or something like that. You can stay as you are. You can serve God in the circumstances in which you find yourself. And in order to make it clear what he's saying here is in relationship to the slave, let me show you what I mean, how you can still be a slave and be serving God. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So, look, if you happen to be the servant of a human master, if your role in this life is, I serve this guy over here, in the deepest sense, in the sense that really matters, you are free. Because Christ has bought you with his blood. You were a slave of sin and death. You were doomed to destruction. You could not get out of your own way. You could do nothing but trip and fall and destroy yourself. And now you have been saved. Now you have been freed. You're not going to pay the price for your guilt and sin. You're not going to suffer forever from your own iniquity. You have been rescued. So, even though you are in service to this person, in the deepest sense, you have been freed. From everything you need to be freed from, you have found freedom. Likewise, if you're a freeman, if you are not a slave, but you live as your own master in this world, the fact is that's not really true. In the deepest sense, you are not your own master. You are a slave of Christ. You belong to him. He is your master. He bought you with his blood, meaning that he bought you for his own purposes. He rescued you not just so that he could pluck you out of the fire and set you on the side and say, okay, go away and do whatever you want. He has called us to follow him, to learn from him, to obey him. So, what Paul's getting at here is, you see why it doesn't matter ultimately in the deepest sense whether you get out of being a slave or not? Because even though in a world sense you're a slave, you are truly free in the deepest sense. And if in the world sense you were free and not a slave, in the deepest sense nonetheless, you have an obligation as a slave, as a servant to your master who is Christ. So if you talk about the real issues go much deeper than the superficial circumstances of your life. And so then he concludes, brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called. So, he's saying, look, your new calling in Christ does not mean that somehow you need to stop having sexual relations with your spouse, or you need to get divorced from your spouse so you can be holy and pure and separate, or you can separate from your unbelieving spouse so that you're not tainted by their presence or something like that. That's not what your calling in Christ means. It doesn't mean that you have to stop being Jewish or start being Jewish. It doesn't mean that you have to run away from your human master because you have to free yourself from all human relationships. That's just the circumstances of this life. That's not the biggest issue. Don't sweat the small stuff, he's saying. And notice, whether I'm married or not, whether I'm a slave or not, whether I'm living a life as a Jew or not, that's all the small stuff from his perspective. Because the big stuff relates to my relationship with God, which has eternal consequences. Am I going to be saved from this world or not? This world is going, and there are those who are going to be rescued out of the rubble, and there are those who are going to be destroyed by it. And the issue is, which am I? In the light of which, whether I am married or not, or whether I am a slave or not, or whether I am a Jew or not, is small potatoes. It doesn't matter that much. Now, not that my life is not important, or that I shouldn't try to live it with integrity, or value the gifts that God has given me in marriage, or in singleness, or whatever. It's just, in the hierarchy of things, it's not the most important thing. It has value, but not as much value as my eternal destiny has. Okay, so one of the things I really wanted to bring out here at the end is that the theme in this section, this idea that Paul's talking about, he's making this contrast between kind of a picture of a life that is religiously devoted to God, where I have somehow, I think that I need to purify my life in some religious sense in order to be pleasing to God, versus the moral aspect of life. The key in this whole section is what he says is what matters is keeping the commandments of God. Whether or not I am married or not is not in the final issue relevant in keeping the commandments of God. What's relevant is where do I find myself? If I am married, I need to keep my marriage vows. That's something I am called upon to do. If I am not married, I am called upon to not have sexual relations with other people because I am not married to anyone. That is a part of obeying God and keeping His commandment. But whether or not I am a married person or not a married person, in and of itself is not any sort of a religious obligation on my part. God has not required of me that I choose one or the other of those things in order to be obedient to Him. At least not in any general sort of sense. So that's the theme that is coming out here. Does God want you to live on some higher sexless plane? No, He wants you to keep your marriage vows. Does He want you to keep the Jewish rituals or stop keeping the Jewish rituals? No, He wants you to learn what is good and obey Him. Does He want you to pull out of every human relationship like the God who is calling me into life? Those are the real issues of my life. The circumstances of my life are not nothing, but they take a subordinate role. In fact, one of the things that this life is all about is living in the circumstances in which I find myself and choosing for the eternal in the midst of the temporal, in the midst of the everyday circumstances of my life, making this choice for God and for the calling to eternal life and to righteousness that He has made. So I think that informs everything that Paul's trying to say here. You guys have gotten it in your heads that there is this somehow hyper-spirituality that God has called you to that involves abstaining from everything or something like that. You've got it all wrong. What God has called us to is to live the lives we have in the light of the truth, whatever lives we may have, married, unmarried, Jew, Gentile, slave, free, whatever circumstances you find yourself in. Think about them in terms of the master that you really serve and the implications of that service for what you're doing now, which is not going to be necessarily change your circumstances, but rather live them out faithfully. Love your neighbor as yourself, even if your neighbor is an unbelieving spouse, or even if your neighbor is your master. Love God with all your heart, soul, and strength, even if following Him and loving Him means staying in a difficult situation because He wants me to. That's where the real rubber meets the road. And gaining that perspective that what God wants of me is to learn His values and live them out in the circumstances I find myself, rather than achieving some theoretical hyper-spirituality, that's a great step of wisdom. When we come to recognize that stay where you are, be faithful where you are, is actually a profoundly spiritual directive, then I think we really have come to understand something about God and what He wants from us. Okay, so let me give you a few minutes to ask any questions, make any comments.
Would you make a quick pass by the spouse being sanctified and the children being holy again?
Yes. Think about sanctification in terms of that which is sanctified is that which is set apart for God, acceptable to God, and that that sort of thing. So I think what he's saying is, it is not that the unbelieving spouse makes you unacceptable, which is what they're thinking. It is rather, by virtue of the fact that you're married to them, your marriage makes your relationship with them acceptable. And so they are acceptable as your spouse. You don't need to part from them. They are sanctified. They are not something to avoid because they are an unholy thing that God wants you to depart from. They are sanctified by you as a believer faithfully. This is the part that he doesn't say explicitly, but what I'm saying is, what sanctifies them? It's the fact that I am married to them. I, as a believer, am being faithful to my marriage vow, and therefore they are not an unholy, unacceptable person that's making me unacceptable. It is rather they are acceptable as my spouse. They have been sanctified as my spouse, even though they're not a believer, and if we had not been married, it would be unwise for me to choose to marry them, probably. The fact is, we are married, therefore they are acceptable. And my children, really what he's doing there is taking the logic of their position. He's saying, otherwise, by your way of thinking, the children would be unacceptable. They would be this product of an illicit sort of union that shouldn't be happening. Whereas the fact is, no, your children are holy. They're acceptable as well. God looks on this as a good thing, a good and holy thing. Does that mean they're saved? No. But this marriage and the children that resulted from it, that's a good thing in his mind, not a bad thing. You're the ones who are confused in thinking that you need to get out of this because this is bad to have this contact with an unbeliever. No, you're married to them. It's sanctified. They are sanctified.
Is it the same thing as the meat sacrificed to idols? You receive it with thanksgiving and bless it and go ahead and eat it. It doesn't make you unholy. It's just a meal.
Yes. Yes. In that sense, that idea that somehow there's some almost like
taint.
Substance, spiritual substance that's tainting me or something like that. Yeah, Paul does not have that view. That's how he can say this. Is that no, that's... It's not that there is some contagion that's somehow coming to you of unholiness. It's a moral issue. This is your spouse. So it's right for you to be married to them. Which actually, if you get a hold of that idea, it's profoundly significant. I mean, just think about that. Go ahead.
I appreciate the contrast between the moral principles, and I guess I see this, it sounds like, as I've read this and heard the whole Bible in the past, was more like looking for the list that was, if I find the right rules, then I'll have it down, and learning the context here is real important. What the Corinthians were doing differently, different circumstances, but maybe it was a similar thing, trying to find out, now what do I do in each situation is kind of a way of to get more control of my life. If I have this down pat right, the way God, in God's eyes, I'm doing this right, then something's taken care of and I can have, control and peace or whatever in my life. And it makes me think, the issue that stands out to me as I would have read this before, where it starts in verse 12, talking to the believing person with the unbelieving spouse, was never my issue, but it seems like people I've known and things, other Christians, it's something where you almost try to find the list there of, okay, sit down with your spouse. Now, do you want to stay with me, or
right.
If that's good, if not, well, just go. This will all be cut and dried and everything.
Right.
Whereas, if you look at the moral, or just the real life that happens between people, someone, they may have this real messy situation in a marriage. Someone stays and then they go and then they, all this stuff happens. So you can't really even find a list from that.
Right.
Of what's going, I mean, but it's so important to read where it's, you know, the condition you're in, that's what you're in and that's what you're called to, and it may not all become clear in 5 weeks or something.
Right.
But that helps me to think about that.
Yes. It's very important. And we read something like this, and as you say, we think, okay, I look at the various rules I've got in the Bible. I'm married to a person who says they're a believer. Okay, so according to the rules in the Bible, I'm stuck with that. Can't do anything with that. But, oh no, this person now, I'm married to a person who says they're not a believer. So I have an option. Now let's pursue this. You want to go or not? I mean, we're free to part if you want to leave, because Paul said it's okay. So, I mean, I couldn't have this conversation with a believer, but if it's an unbeliever, I can have this because Paul has said it's okay to have this conversation. And then, so, okay, oh, well, I don't, okay, sure, I'll go. Okay, great. No, we've got to come at it from the other side. Paul, as you say, he's not setting up, this is not case law as in, let me tell you what you do in this situation and this situation in that sense. He's speaking to the principles that they ought to be operating by in these situations. And let me make a comment. I think some people, when they hear me talk about principles, they think, oh, what you mean is, oh, there's no rules, just principles. So what that means is I can really do whatever I want. No. The principles we're talking about here are huge moral building blocks of the fabric of reality. I mean, we're not talking about take it or leave it stuff. I mean, this is big stuff. But what we're saying is the issue is we need to frame it in different terms. The issue is, as far as it depends on me, I should not be thinking, in this situation, for instance, the Corinthians should not be thinking, oh, I need to get out of this relationship because it is staining me before God. I should think instead, God calls me to be faithful in my marriage, and so God approves of me staying with this person because it is appropriate for me to keep my marriage vows. That's huge. I mean, that is a huge thing. And then it so happens that the fact is, if with an unbeliever in that situation, they may choose to leave. Well, if they choose to leave, then there's nothing I can do about it. Which is true in lots of situations if they choose to leave. But he's talking about how they ought to be thinking about the issue that they're confronting him with. This has implications for lots of different issues that we might face, and even implications for things outside of marriage. But what he's trying to do is to get them to think about the truths that God has given them that apply in this situation, which is not lightly dismissing what is right. It is taking it on and taking it seriously, but recognizing that it tells me, it gives me the framework. It tells me what's true as I seek to work out the specific circumstances of my life. Not every circumstance that a person might face has been addressed by the Bible, but various circumstances have been addressed to give me the parameters, to give me the idea of what are the truths that I'm operating by. And one of the truths I'm operating by is that as far as it depends on me, I need to be faithful to my marriage vows. Another truth I'm operating by is that my life is not defined by some sort of hyper-spirituality, but by being faithful, loving my neighbor as myself, keeping my promises, and so on, in the context of my everyday, mundane life. These are the principles that I'm trying to learn and live out in all kinds of situations, some of which the Bible hasn't spoken to at all. So, that's good. Okay.
For the first part of this morning, I was a little confused by your contrast between, like, choose morality, not choose to change your circumstances, because it seems to me like choosing morality might sometimes change your circumstances.
Right.
So the point Paul is making, though, is like focus on your morality, and if your circumstances change through that, fine, but don't just focus on your circumstances, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that I see what you're saying. You have to, the kinds of circumstances that we're talking about in particular are things like the question of being a Jew or not being a Jew, where a mistaken idea of my religious obligations before God would lead me to think that I ought to change things, that I need to, you know, I'm going to show my devotion to God by living on top of a pole for 10 years or something, you know, that kind of thing. Obviously, the circumstances of my life are going to change whether I want them to or not. Change is a part of life. Nothing wrong with that. When I make moral decisions, I change the circumstances of my life. If I was a drug dealer and I stop doing that, I've changed the circumstances of my life, and that's a good thing. And I can choose to change the circumstances of my life religiously, too. I mean, I could choose to live as a Jew if I wanted to. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that, as long as I'm not doing it out of the mistaken idea that somehow I am buying God's favor in doing so, or that this is the heart of what God has called me to. So it's not the circumstances in and of themselves. The issue is thinking that there are these things that I can do in life that will make me a more spiritual person, when in fact I'm not really addressing moral issues, which always will make me more spiritual to be pursuing what is good rather than what is evil, but I'm pursuing some sort of illusory picture of what God would be pleased with if I were to change my life. That's the kind of circumstances that he has in mind in particular. So yeah, that's a good question. I'll clarify that. Okay, so we've come to the end, I think. We'll remember that next week, if you come here, they won't let you in. That's why we're not going to be here. So 11 o'clock, is it, at Fern Ridge Reservoir. We'll be having a picnic. And then the week after that, we will be here. And then...